Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
We're ready and raring to go to talk about the greatest NFL players that wore jersey number 85. And today's guest is John Turney, who's really set statistics on their ear this summer with him and the Pro Football Journal team powering up Pro Football Reference to give us all the great stats. And John's here to share with jersey number 85 in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome to the Pigpen. We have another bonus edition. We're talking about the jersey numbers of the NFL, and we are at jersey number 85. And we have a special guest to help us today from the Pro Football Journal, John Turney. John Turney, welcome to the Pigpen.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Well, this is the thrill is all ours, my friend. I appreciate you coming on. Now, John, maybe if just to start off, we could just learn a little bit about you, where your football fandom comes from. Maybe you could just take us through the progression of what got you so interested in the game of football to have a website on it.
Well, I'm probably quite a bit older than a lot of your listeners. I'm 57, but my father was a fan, and my older brother. So as early as 1970, 71, I was familiar with football and became a fan about that time. I didn't know anything, obviously, and then as I got older, played lower level football, high school, and so forth, and was a very average player, if at that, and then became just a fan. I was really interested in all aspects of the game. You know, uniform numbers is one of them, but I like uniforms, I like the statistics, I like playing it. Like watching it on television, and then I got into doing research, and it grew from there. And then I got into coaching some semi-pro as well, and that's been very satisfying. So it's really been a lifelong endeavor, if you will.
Wow, that's quite the story there. I mean, I'm right in the same age group as you, and I think a lot of our listeners are too. I'm 55, so you're not out there by yourself here. Everything you're going to talk about is very relevant to me and many of the listeners. In case we have a listener maybe that just woke up something, you know, from a deep sleep, can you tell us a little bit about what the Pro Football Journal website is all about?
Well, it's essentially my way of getting all my thoughts on paper, if you will. You can't do it on paper anymore, but it's a journal. I write whatever comes to mind, and I've got some really solid people that contribute as well. Nick Webster does, TJ Troop does, and Chris Willis of NFL Films does. And we try to cover things that we call it esoteric, things that not everybody's interested in. Sometimes that'll include uniforms or uniform numbers, but also obscure statistics and tackle statistics that you can't get from other websites. Chris Willis is an expert in pre-World War II football. He's written books on Red Grange and Dutch Clark and others. He's going to be doing the definitive work on Bronco Nagurski in the next year or two. Well, I think he's getting close to getting done, but it won't come out till next year. A few of us have been on NFL Films Presents, doing our research and things like that. So it's a website where people can get things that are just not the ordinary things. That's at least what our goal is.
definitely all of you do such a great job at that. I know I was looking through last night at it, and Chris Willis's article on the Red Grange in the candy company. I mean, some eye-catching photos there and some great stories there. But you have a lot of treasures in the Pro Football Journal that are just awesome to look at. So we appreciate what you do.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate the compliment.
Well, I know you have been quite the story here this summer. You mentioned Nick Webster with the Pro Football Reference having the sack totals prior to the 1982 season, and the NFL only recognized 1982 on. But you and Nick did this, a lot of work. I believe it was like 30-some years of work to bring sack totals to some generations of football players that didn't have them recorded before. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, that started back in the early 90s. Lawrence Taylor became the all-time sack leader. I believe it was in 1992. It was on the Giants games when you would watch them, and they would show his total of surpassing Dexter Manley at the time. But it was just odd to me that they weren't counting his rookie season, which was 1981. So his total was approaching what his career total turned out to be, was 132 and a half, and they just weren't counting his rookie year. But anybody who had, football cards or got any of the football preview magazines at the time or media guides knew that he had 9.5 back in his rookie year. It was just odd that they didn't kind of grandfather in the current players, even if it was just for a few years. But that led, one thing led to another, and when I found out these things called the game books exist, they used to call them play-by-plays, that's what got me going. Then I would go to different cities when I had the opportunity and talk to the PR folks. They'd let me in, and I would do the research for sacks. And then a couple years into it, Nick Webster gave me a call and was interested in getting the data, so I shared it with him and found out he was on the East Coast, and he was able to visit cities I wasn't really able to get to readily. So that's kind of how that started. We got most of it done within the first 5-8 years, but boy, the hard part is finding the gaps. I would say 90% of the work was finding 10% of the missing facts, because game books were not complete at the time. And sometimes you just had to really dig into the film and newspapers or whatever you could do to find missing facts. And I wish it could be a little more complete. It's really good, I believe, from the mid-60s on. But in the early 60s, there's just so many missing things. I wish it could have been better. And we're working on the 1950s now, and that may be something we never be able to complete. But that's kind of our white whale, is the sack totals from the 1950s. So that's where we're going now.
It's got to be a lot of work, because I know I've looked at some of those game books that are out there, and some of them are like, handwritten. The penmanship's not the greatest. The copies aren't the greatest. I mean, that is a lion's share of work that you folks did to get those stats. So our hats are off to you on that.
Well, thanks. I think it does, even though we don't advocate that they become official. I don't think it matters if a statistic is official or not. What matters is if it happened or not. So whether the NFL ever gives Lawrence Taylor credit for his full 142 doesn't matter. Fans can look and see that he had the 9.5 as a rookie, and then all the other players that we've talked about and that have been written about, Bubba Baker getting 23 sacks and having the unofficial record. I think that's fine. It gives people an idea of what happened, and I think that's what's more important than any specific number or any specific statistic. All football statistics are skewed in some way or another just based on how the game is played. Even baseball statistics are skewed because you don't know who was pitching. You have to know the dimensions of the ball field, those kinds of things, and that's what makes sports interesting. If it were static, nobody would care because everybody would be on that level playing field, and it's really not, and that's what makes discussions interesting.
That is very well said and very well stated, and I can't even imagine the amount of work it took to do that. But we've got a little bit of work here ourselves today, because I've brought you into the challenge with myself here to discuss some of these greatest players in NFL history that wore jersey number 85. And I think we're going to be up to the task here with your vast knowledge of the NFL. And I'm excited to hear what we have to say here.
Well, hopefully I can bring a little extra to the table through some statistic notes that I can give you as we go along. But listen to some of the past ones, and everybody's done a really good job, and it's fun hearing about these players who we grew up watching and even current players that are doing well wearing current these numbers. So, maybe it'll be interesting to folks. We'll let them be the judge, I guess.
Okay. Well, I'm going to just wet our whistles just a little bit. I'm just going to mention by name and not go into any stories or statistics, but usually we start off with the Pro Football Hall of Fame, who they say wore the jersey number. And the Pro Football Hall of Fame has four players enshrined that wore jersey number 85, according to them. And that's Jack Youngblood, Nick Buonocore, Art Monk, and Rayfield Wright. I don't know if that maybe gets us kick-started here into these jersey 85s.
Well, interesting, Rayfield Wright normally wore number 70 as a right tackle, but people forget that he was a tight end his first couple of years and wore number 85 as a backup tight end. He didn't become a tackle until 1969 and then became a starter in 1970. Another guy who wore number 85 before he wore number 70 was Russ Washington. He was a gentleman, a right tackle for the Chargers. He just passed away. They called him Mount Washington or Big Roo. He was 6'7", listed at 295, but probably closer to 310, 320. And he was a defensive tackle his first couple of years, and he wore number 85. And then in 1970, converted to right tackle. So there's a little bit of parallel there with 85 and those guys changing to number 70 and then moving to right tackle. And ironically, Jack Youngblood calls those two guys the best players he's ever faced. Rayfield Wright, he says, gave him fits, and he said, I don't think I ever got anything off of Russ Washington. So there's the tie-in with Jack Youngblood as well.
Wow, that is a great segue into Mr. Youngblood. So would you like to talk a little bit more about him?
Yeah, I think he's still probably, in my view, he's the most underrated Hall of Famer because he has all the things you could ask for in a Hall of Fame resume, but when the all-time teams come out, he never gets mentioned. If it's a top 100 list, the Athletic just did a top 100 list and he didn't make that, but here's a guy who was a five-time consensus All-Pro and three-time second-team All-Pro. Had 151 in a career sacks. He had the legendary run where he played the playoff games and the Pro Bowl with a fractured fibula. He was somebody who was known as a tough player. He was had testimonials from guys who said, hey, this is the best guy I ever faced. Ron Yeary said that. Dan Dierdorf said that. Fran Tarkenton said that, he's the best defensive guy I ever faced. Roger Staubach, in his book, Time Enough to Win, said I'd have to give Jack Youngblood the vote as the toughest defensive player I've ever faced. So he has all those things on his resume, yet he can't make the NFL's century team. He was beaten out by guys, in my opinion, that have lesser resumes, and he's continues to get slighted for whatever reason. That's kind of how his career is unfolded. He produced, was consistent, played a long time, played tough. People who played against him said he was the best or one of the best. Coaches respected him. Yet the writers never really got it. They just don't understand how good a player he was.
I totally agree with everything you're saying. It's kind of interesting. I was reading up on him the other day, and I didn't realize this. When he came to the Rams, he played behind Deacon Jones his first year, so he didn't get much playing time there. And they ended up the Rams ended up trading Deacon, and then he split time with Fred Dreyer, which I found pretty interesting. So two other Hall of Famers that he sort of learned and cut his teeth on in the NFL was kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, that second year, he was generally the starter. He split a little bit of time with Fred Dreyer, but we've written about that, and it kind of was one of those things where they were giving credit to both players, but I would say, you know, Youngblood in 1972, that year he split time, so-called, with Dreyer. Youngblood still led the defensive lineman in tackles. He led the defensive lineman in hurries. So he really got, you know, 80, 90% of the playing time. And there were times when they would both be on the field, he and Fred Dreyer, playing what was called a 57 defense, where they would move Hoy Bacon, the starting end, to tackle, and then they would have kind of a three defensive end pass rush. And you're right about the rookie season for Youngblood. He backed up Jones and started about three games and then played probably the majority of a couple more where Pickett would kind of give it a try, couldn't go because of that arch. So you're right, in essence, but I would say he was really the starter in 72.
I mean, the main thing is, you know, the Rams were not deficient at all on that defensive line back in that era. I mean, they had that the whole thing with, you know, Deacon and Fred Dreyer, and wasn't Merlin Olsen on that line also?
He was.
Then the draft Youngblood. Wow, that's really restocking the shelves there.
Yeah, they did a really good job with that. And the fearsome foursome, which took place in the 60s with Deacon and another number 85, Lamar Lundy, was the right end, who had a good career, moved into kind of a second version of the fearsome foursome with Youngblood, Dreyer, Brooks, and again Olsen. So a lot of folks will forget how good that defense was. During the 1970s, no team stopped the run better. No team allowed fewer rushing touchdowns. No team had more sacks. And only the Vikings allowed fewer points than the Rams in the 1970s. So this was an elite defense for a long time.
It definitely is. Probably the unfortunate thing for them is that they were in the NFC when you had some pretty good Cowboys and Vikings and Redskins teams that were in there.
Now's a good time to take a break and hear a few words from our sponsor. We'll be right back with John Turney and the Jersey number 85s in just a moment.
Hey, are you ready for some football? Some fantasy football? How about some daily fantasy football? Silly questions, right? Of course you are. You're ready to talk some smack and win some cash every Sunday, and Thursday, and Monday, and whenever there's football games. The Sports History Network invites you to play your daily fantasy football this season at ThriveFantasy.com. Thrive Fantasy offers hundreds of thousands, millions in cash every day on NBA, MLB, PGA, golf, cricket, esports, and of course, NFL football. And just to get the 2021 NFL season started right, Thrive Fantasy is holding its $100,000 guaranteed contest with a $20,000 first prize. Sign up with Thrive Fantasy today to get a 100% match bonus on your first deposit for up to $100 in free daily fantasy football play. Visit sportshistorynetwork.com/thrive. That's THRIVE. Or enter promo code SHN when depositing at the cashier. Join Thrive Fantasy today, earn cash prizes, and support great shows like this at the Sports History Network. Now that's a win-win-win situation for you to kick off your own NFL season.
Now let's resume our talk with John Turney of the Pro Football Journal on Jersey number 85s and the greatest in history.
John, maybe you could talk about one of our other Hall of Famers, Nick Buonocorsi.
Yeah, he was underappreciated kind of guy. He didn't get as much all-pro notice as he might have because it was a great era for middle linebackers. But he was the leader of the no-name defense and almost always the leading tackler on his team, if not every year. He had a high of 142 tackles one year, and he was knocking down passes, and he intercepted a bunch. So it's really, he's got to be number two on the list as the best player to ever wear number 85 behind Youngblood.
I do not disagree that a bit. I mean, interesting story is when Nick came out of Notre Dame, his coach at Notre Dame, and I think it might have been Parsegian, I'm not sure about that, he told the pro scouts that Buonocorsi, he felt, was too small to play in the NFL. And I guess many of the NFL scouts believed him because he had to go into the AFL. But what did he prove everybody wrong with his play?
Yeah, and they listed him at 5'11". I'm not sure he was quite that tall. but he had a lot of smarts and he had enough quickness to get in the passing lane through that means, but he wasn't able to have the height sometimes, and it could have hurt him a little bit, but nonetheless, he was a guy who ended up with 1,300-1,400 career tackles by our research, so, and a deserving Hall of Famer in my view.
Most definitely. When you lead a defense that is called the no-name defense and you go undefeated and win a championship, that's a pretty good record right there to get you in.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And then in 1973, the defense was even better than it was in 1972. So it was an elite defense for 4 or 5 years, I would say between 70 and 74, with that peak in 1972-73 and the back-to-back Super Bowl wins.
And I agree with you of him being the second one on there with Youngblood on our list here. Do we want to stay with our Hall of Famers, or do we want to go off script here a little bit? Because I know the other two Hall of Famers, Art Monk and Rayfield Wright, only wore that jersey number for one season each, where Youngblood and Bonacani were 14 and 15 years respectively. We're in 85.
Monk, we know him more from the Redskins, and 85 was when he moved away from them. So, yeah, I mean, there's a potential Hall of Famer in Antonio Gates for the Chargers, who wore number 85, and he went to all those Pro Bowls and was a converted basketball player, moved into the NFL and became a star tight end, much like Tony Gonzalez in a way. Both were basketball players. The difference was that Gonzalez at least played college football. Antonio Gates didn't.
Seems to be the trend of some of the tight ends that are in the modern NFL right now. You know, I think, like you said, Gonzalez and Gates are sort of the ones that open those floodgates. But now you have a lot of athletic tight ends coming in, and a lot of them former basketball players are sort of the same skill set and, reaching up to grab passes like you would a basketball. And, of course, the great size doesn't hurt either.
Yeah, and when you play basketball, of course, you've got to have leaping ability, and then Antonio Gates had that. Although he got bigger and bigger as he played in the NFL, so I'm not sure he retained all those hops, but he was certainly an effective player and has a shot at the Hall of Fame. I don't know if he'll make it or not, but he's got what anybody would say are Hall of Fame numbers. It's going to be the intangibles that he may or may lack that would keep him out or make him wait for quite a while.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I would tend to lean towards it also, that I think he's very deserving of getting in there. But, you know, like you said, who knows how the folks that vote, the sports writers and that, are going to look at him when he becomes eligible, which I believe is in a year or two he'll be eligible to go in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and he certainly was an effective weapon in the end zone with over 100 career touchdown receptions. So that's going to be the one thing that that can't be denied. He was a guy who could be relied on in the red zone and score you points. So that's where he's going to have his case made for him.
Most definitely. Most definitely. Okay, now who else do you have we can talk about?
Yeah, the current guy is probably George Kittle, who's another one of the guys that we're talking about in terms of being a great receiver and a good athlete. He's my favorite tight end right now, because he can block. He's kind of a Gronk Jr. A lot of other folks like Travis Kelce, and that's fine, but I just think Kittle's got the complete package. So I think he's a guy who's on an Hall of Fame arc, but he's still, we got 10, 12 years to go before we can find out if he can sustain it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think he is by far probably the best tight end in the game right now. Even maybe Gronk in his prime would have overtook him. But, yeah, Kittle is definitely a weapon for the 49ers and very, very tough to defend.
Another 85 I liked as a kid, one of my favorites, was Isaac Curtis for the Bengals. He was a tall, fast receiver, and for some reason I always liked the wide receivers that averaged over 20 yards a catch. To me, that just looked really cool in the statistical category. You see the line where some guys were averaging 16, 17, but you see Isaac Curtis and Roger Carr and Cliff Branch at 20, 22. And for some reason, that always caught my eye as a kid. I don't know. But Isaac Curtis was certainly special in the mid-70s.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I'm a Steelers fan here in Western Pennsylvania, and I remember he was one of those guys that you just feared when the Steelers would be playing the Bengals, that even with the great defense the Steelers had, he seems like he always had their number. always would have a big game against them, and guy was just a gamer, that's for sure.
Yeah, and it was a different era where if a wide receiver caught three passes in a game and they were for 60 yards, that was a big deal. That would end the season with 45 catches for 900 or 1,000 yards. So they didn't have the opportunities in that kind of a dead ball passing era. And that was the case for a lot of those guys, where modern guys, younger guys, kids will say, oh, he didn't have Hall of Fame numbers. And then you just have to remind them you had to see him play. That's like Lynn Swann and Drew Pearson and so forth. But Isaac Curtis was in that same category at his peak. I don't think he sustained it as long, and I think he got hurt a little bit and the offense changed and so forth. But at his peak, there was four or five guys that were super deep threats, and he was one of them. And he was 6'3", 190 pounds, and could run the 4.3 40. He was a track guy at San Diego State. So he was super talented. It'd be fun to watch him play today.
Yeah, I think he would probably definitely fit the mold of what offensive coordinators are looking at today. And so it really made him dangerous back in the 70s when he played in the 80s. But like you said, they didn't air the ball out as much as they do today, and didn't have the same formations set on the pass. It was a run-first league even then. So, yeah, but great player, Isaac Curtis, definitely. Who else do we have on the docket for today for 85?
Well, we mentioned him a little bit. Lamar Lundy was a right end for the Rams' fearsome foursome, and he actually led the team in sacks in 1961. With 11, and he had other seasons where he had close to double digits, so he could play. So he's one who's not on the front burner of a lot of guys' memories for being an 85, but I think he's one of them. He was not necessarily one of my favorites, but he's just one of those guys who was always steady and was kind of a leader type on that fearsome foursome.
I don't disagree with that. That's a very good point there on him also. Who else do you have here for 85 that's a significant player?
In my mind, Julius Adams for the Patriots is somebody who fits that mold as being significant. He was there from 71 to 85 and then retired for a year and came back in 87 to help out the team. But he went to the Pro Bowl only once. But he was a steady player who moved around a lot. He started off as a defensive end and moved to a tackle. Then in 74, when the Patriots were among the first teams to play a 3-4 full-time as a base defense, Adams got moved to that position, 5 technique, or even 4 technique, head up on the tackle. So he didn't have pretty numbers like some of the defensive ends of his era, but he did just a tremendous job because he was extremely strong, just natural strength, and he could get some pressure on the quarterback from his right end position. So he's a forgotten player and another one of those great ones that we've lost over the past several years. He passed away at a fairly young age, and it's just really too bad, but he was part of a tremendous 1971 defensive end draft class that included, as we've mentioned, Youngblood, but Adams was there, and Tony McGee was there, and Lyle Alzado came out of that, and there was a lot of really good defensive ends that came out of the 71 draft.
Wow, okay, I didn't realize they all came out at the same time. You're right, that is quite a collection of great ends that came out for playing on the defensive side. So, okay.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you who you have next.
Well, Mel Gray is in the same category, I think, as Isaac Curtis. He was another one of those 20-yard-a-catch guys that could get down the field. He was even faster than Isaac Curtis. Back then, they talked in terms of 100-yard dash times as much as they did 40 yards, and Mel Gray was a 9.2 guy. Isaac Curtis was a 9.3 guy, and for comparison, Cliff Branch, who just got the senior nomination for the Hall of Fame, was a 9.2 guy. So Mel Gray was right there. He was a deep threat in the Big Red offense, the comeback kids, and he was somebody who was kind of special as well. He was a smaller guy, 5'9", maybe 170, but he could sure get deep. And he was another fun one that you would remember from the 70s.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I can remember Hart dropping back a pass and launching some out to him as he'd go down the field. Another great one to remember. Glad you brought him up.
Yeah, so there's Wesley Walker is another one like that. Mark Duper, both of them are guys that sometimes Duper never averaged 20 yards a catch in the season, but boy, he was close one year. And in his era, that was pretty special. So I liked him a lot. He was kind of a Mel Gray type, and he was 5'9", a shorter kind of guy, and I think he was somebody who's still a little bit underrated. A lot of people like Mark Clayton better than him, but I think Duper had probably the more consistent career. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but that's what I think.
Well, you know, they were both so close. You know, I think they just complemented each other, and almost like Swan and Stallworth, or players like that. I don't know that one would have had the success without the other one being on the other side. Of course, having somebody slinging the rock like Dan Marino doesn't hurt either.
No, absolutely not. And I don't mean to slight Mark Clayton, but Mark Duper was kind of special as well. So I liked him a lot. Wesley Walker was another guy that, I don't know, maybe we have several guys that were number 85 that were deep threats. Wesley Walker's first couple of years was averaging 24 yards a catch. He was a deep threat for the Jets. And I think he might have been the all-time leader in yards per catch statistics for his first, I don't know, 5-6 years. Then he became more of a possession receiver and his numbers dropped. But he was somebody who, he could get deep as well. So I remember watching him, and what I thought was interesting is his number, 85, looked great when the Jets changed their uniforms in 1978. I don't know if you remember that. They went to the green helmet, and Wesley Walker, to me, kind of was the epitome of that, and that number, the font they used, just looked great on that jersey. So that's one thing I remember about him.
Yeah, I agree. I like those uniforms, especially the helmets that the Jets had then. That was kind of a cool, and had the word Jets wrote on it, and it sort of had like an emblem of a jet, the line of going underneath it. I thought those were pretty neat. I'm surprised they went away from those.
Yeah, and so another at 45 is Chad Ochocinco, or Chad Johnson, however we want to call him, and he probably has the best numbers of any of the receivers. However, he wasn't one of my favorites because he just played in a different era where those receiving yards and catches came a lot easier. No denying that at his peak, he was an excellent player, a Pro Bowl-level guy.
Yeah, he was definitely in an era where he got to catch the pass a lot more, and sort of that era where the receivers started becoming the sort of the divas that they're monikered here the last couple decades. He was one of those that sort of fit the bill on that. And sometimes he was kind of interesting to watch, especially when he went to the Ochocinco type things. But sometimes maybe it wasn't appealing to the masses of the NFL fan.
Yeah, probably so. But when he changed his name to 85, Ochocinco, and wearing number 85, that's got to be the only time that's ever happened, as far as I know. Although he had to kind of go to the courts to change the name, but I thought that was a double 85, if you will. His name's 85, number's 85, and he tried to make that into a marketing thing. Unfortunately, by the time he did it, I just don't think he was at his peak anymore. So it became kind of a novelty, almost a little bit of a joke.
I agree with you there. That's probably just a little bit too late. He probably would have made a few more dollars off it maybe 3 or 4 years prior to that when he did it. So interesting.
One of the last guys to have that maybe your listeners would like to know about is Bill Schaffner. Now, he's a guy who was a wide receiver for the Giants. He started off at the Rams wearing number 29, goes to the Giants, and he changes to number 85. One of the very few wide receivers that was a five-time first-team All-Pro. Folks can go on Pro Football Reference and look up wide receivers and how many of them were five-time All-Pros? Very few. You're talking Jerry Rice, Don Hudson, and Lance Allworth are the guys that had more All-Pros than he did. Yet he almost gets no attention for the Hall of Fame. He was a split end that was on the one receiver side. And according to my colleague at Pro Football Journal, T.J. Troop was really the guy who caused defenses to rotate to that one receiver side, which was kind of what they tried to credit Bob Hayes with, as quote-unquote changing the game. Well, I'm sure they did it probably more for Bob Hayes because he was a faster player, but Del Shoffner was almost as fast. He was a lightning-fast guy. And according to TJ, said that's usually zone defenses of the day, cover threes, would rotate to the two-receiver side. That's just how they were designed. But if you have to reverse that, that means you're putting double coverage on that split end, which is what Del Shoffner was, that he had more to do with that kind of defense than even Bob Hayes did. And not many of your listeners would know that. So I thought that was an interesting tidbit. I had to learn it from TJ myself.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. I mean, I remember the name, but I didn't realize the five-time All-Pros and the statistics in that light. So that's a very interesting, very observant of your cohort there. Great job.
He's just we like to study the film as well as count things at Pro Football Journal.
Well, that's awesome. That's a great little tidbit. Much appreciated. And now, do you have anybody else you want to talk about from the 85s?
That's really all I had written down. Now, if you have some that I may have missed, I'd be glad to comment on them if I know anything about them.
Well, we have kind of an interesting wide receiver in Drew Hill that played back in the era that you and I have both remember watching, I'm sure.
Yeah, and he started off wearing number 87 for the Rams, and he was a deep threat for them. He was their guy who could average 20 yards a catch. He was running a lot of deep ends and go routes. Then he goes to the Oilers, and they have a completely different offense. And he becomes a starter, and he is in that run and shoot. And then he catches tons of passes and is one of their outside guys in that. He wasn't one of the slot guys. So he had to put up really good numbers because of that scheme, and was perfect for it since he was kind of a Smurf-like guy. 5'9", 170, kind of in the same mold as Mel Gray we were talking about. And he had tremendous speed, but he wasn't as fast as some of the other guys that we've talked about. Probably more of a 4.35, 4.4, rather than a 4.2, 4.3, if you will. But, yeah, good numbers in a very pass-happy scheme was Drew Hill.
Yeah, that's you could put together quite the track team of these 85s in their prime. Go against almost any other number, and probably be very competitive. There's a lot of fast guys that are on this number.
Yeah, there really are. Gray was lightning fast. Hill was fast. Isaac Curtis was fast. Del Shoffner was fast. You're talking guys that are all 4.4 or better.
Yeah, well, I think even who were we talking about? Wesley Walker, I think, was another one that was a speedster that when he came out with the Jets. So
yeah, out of California, absolutely. He was probably a 4.3 or better. The slowest one we've talked about is probably Ocho Cinco or Derek Mason, who we haven't yet talked about, who is a steady kind of receiver for a couple of teams that put up good numbers but was never a star, but a solid player and worthy of being on any kind of list, the list number 85.
Yeah, most definitely. I was going to just mention him, so I'm glad you brought him up on that. Okay, now do you feel comfortable if we've talked about everybody that's the most substantial players? I mean, there's a lot of great players we haven't talked about, but these are probably the most substantial ones. Are you comfortable with helping me come up with maybe a top 10 list of these guys we've talked about?
Sure, if you'd like to.
Okay, yeah, the listeners really enjoy that. It makes it kind of fun, and we get a lot of comments back on it. Sometimes they agree, sometimes they don't, but makes it more interesting. I think by what you were saying earlier, and I don't disagree, we were going to put Youngblood and Buonocore as our first two on that list.
Yeah, I think Youngblood has to be first, Bonacani second, and then it would be debatable for the rest of the 10 who gets third, fourth, fifth. But, yeah, Antonio Gates, Ocho Cinco, Duper, Julius Adams, I would put on mine, but other people might not put on theirs. Isaac Curtis would definitely be there. And Lamar Lundy, perhaps. Max McGee's an interesting one because he was a really good player earlier in his career, became a backup. Then he was the star of Super Bowl I after, you know, with the famous story of him playing the game with quite a hangover because he didn't know he was going to play. The starting receiver was kind of ill. So here's the guy that made those great catches in Super Bowl I and at least deserves a mention on a list like that.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all with any of those names. Now, how about I think Kittle probably belongs on there too. I mean, I know he's young, he's early on in his career, but I think he's that dominant of a force and probably going to get better as time goes on unless he has some catastrophic injury or something.
Yeah, I think so too because of his skill level. He's an elite player. He just is in the middle of his career. So, yeah, he would definitely be on my top 10. I would just have to sit down and organize it. But, yeah, all these guys are – I think anywhere after 3 to 10 would be almost interchangeable in my view.
I totally agree with you. It would be tough to pick who you'd want to be in certain numbers, you know, after 1 and 2. But, yeah, I don't disagree with you. So I appreciate that you coming on and helping us out here. Those are some great insight. Your website is fantastic. Maybe if you could get everybody your where they can find the Pro Football Journal and maybe your Twitter handle and any other social that you'd like to share with us.
Yeah, Twitter handle is NFL_journal, and that will always lead you to links to Pro Football Journal, which is my blog. And you can also just Google my name, John Turney, and Pro Football Journal, and it will come up. And you can see a lot of my colorizations as well that I do in Photoshop, colorize old photos from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s to try to give people an idea of what they might have looked like. So we try to do a lot of, as we say, esoteric things.
Yeah, the photos are great. I failed to mention that earlier. Those are fantastic. You have quite a collection there. You have quite the talent in doing that, and that's much appreciated, the hard work, I'm sure, and the time it takes to do those.
No, thanks. Appreciate it.
Well, John, I appreciate your time today and for your sharing your knowledge with us on these great players and helping us remember the NFL past players, as we always should, because I can't get to be where we are today without them, that's for sure. And they make it such an interesting time to grow up in, as most of these players were that you and I watched, and even the guys before that, just fantastic players. So thank you very much for all you do on the Pro Football Journal and for sharing your information with us today.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. Appreciate it.
The Pigskin Tales podcast is all about the lesser-known pro football players. Yes, there are stories about the ones we know, like Brad Tarkenton and Harold Red Grange. But have you ever heard of Ernie Nevers? How about Dave Osborne or even Grady Alderman? These men created their own path to the NFL. How did they do it? Listen to the Pigskin Tales podcast, now streaming on your favorite music platform. Go to pigskintales.com.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.